an iconic symbol, which has graced the metropolitan St. Louis area, has a big birthday this year. The fact that it was built at all is a testament to the designer, the innovative building techniques that were developed, and the financing to pay for it. What is it? Well, you can find out on this episode of St. Louis in Tune. Welcome to St. Louis in Tune, and thank you for joining us for fresh perspectives on issues and events with experts, community leaders, and everyday people who are driving change and making an impact that shapes our society and world. I'm Arnold Stricker, along with co-host Mark Langston. Mark, what a great show we're going to have today.
I know. I was just going to say something about it. I'm excited about what we're going to find out about the subject of from our guest.
Yes.
On this edition of our show.
It's known not only here in the St. Louis area, but it's also known across the nation, and we're going to find out internationally. And I'd like to introduce our guest, Dr. John Brown, who's author and professor emeritus at the University of Virginia School of Engineering. He taught history, applied ethics, writing, and public speaking in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society. His articles on communications, get this, Mark, embodied mechanical drawing, dimensional plans, counterfactual history of technology, the creation of knowledge inside firms, and the evolution of antitrust law circa 1912. His publications have won awards from the Railway and Locomotive Historical Society, the Society for Industrial Archaeology, and the Society for the History of Technology. He's the author of The Baldwin Locomotive Works, 1831 to 1915, A Study in American Industrial Practice. And the book we're going to talk to him about today, Spanning the Gilded Age, James Eads and the Great Steel Bridge.
Ooh.
John, welcome to St. Louis in Tune.
It's great to be here, Arnold. I'm really delighted to share all of this with you guys today.
Yes, so we're going to throw that out to the audience. Many of you, you were probably wondering, is it the Arch? No, it's not the Arch. It's the Eads Bridge, 150 years today. And your book's entitled Spanning the Gilded Age. What is the Gilded Age for people who may be not familiar with that?
So historians, we need labels to help people understand periods in history. So, you know, we talk about the New Deal or the Jacksonian era. So in the years after the Civil War, say between the Civil War, which ends in 1865, and maybe 1900, historians have decided we can call that period the Gilded Age as a way to signify a lot of wealth, a lot of growth, maybe some corruption. You know, guilt covers up a lot what's underneath, maybe some fraud even. But so it's a term that's designed to encompass a lot, and it encompasses everything from city growth to those big mansions in Newport, Rhode Island, where the wealthy people paid no attention to the poor. So cities grow dramatically in the Gilded Age. The country really becomes industrial and modern in that period. And I got to say the truth, it's not a great title for an age, for a period of time, but it's what we have. It's
and
what
it was
we work with.
Coined by Mark Twain.
It was coined by Mark Twain. Mark Twain and his co-author, a guy named Charles Dudley Warner, wrote a book where they wanted to draw attention to corruption. And so they called their book The Gilded Age. That came out in about 1873 is when that originated. So, and of course, there is the TV show, the miniseries, The Gilded Age, which is packing a lot of viewers. And so I hope maybe some of those folks will read my book and get a different perspective on The Gilded Age.
Now, some people may know the name J.P. Morgan. They may know the name Andrew Carnegie, and we might get into them. They were involved with the building of the Eads Bridge. And people in St. Louis, they generally know Eads, James Buchanan Eads. He's actually buried here in St. Louis. Was not born here, but was buried here. He's known for a lot of different things. Help our listeners understand a little bit about his background, and then we'll delve into the bridge a little bit.
So, as you say, he wasn't born here. He was born in Indiana, just a few years after statehood for Indiana. Missouri wasn't even a state at that point. And he and his family move to the Mississippi Valley. His parents set up in Iowa. Eads drops out of school at the age of 13, goes to work as a clerk for a few years, has good bosses who really open up their libraries for him, so he studies a lot, even though he's not been in school. And then about the age of 20, he decides he's going to change his life, and he goes out on the river, and he becomes a clerk on a steamboat. So it was the same job, but now he's going up and down the river, and that's a lot more exciting. Got really exciting when that steamboat wrecked. That steamboat hit a snag, a piece of tree trunk underneath the surface of the water, punched a hole in the boat, and it was going to sink very, very quickly. The pilot was a fast thinker. He drove the boat into the shoreline, so everybody got off, but the boat was wrecked, and its cargo was lost. That got Eads to thinking, well, there probably is a lot of wealth under the river if I can just figure out a way to go get it. So he developed his own design for a diving bell, and then he went and he spoke to two boat builders in St. Louis, and he convinced them that they ought to go in together. They would build a salvage boat. He called it a submarine, and they would build the boat and finance him, and he would go out on the water and find the wealth. And that's exactly what he did.
So was that like a diving bell? Or
it was like you would imagine a diving bell, yes. It was a bell. I don't have a lot of very accurate descriptions of it, but my sense is that it's about 4 feet tall and about 3 or 4 feet in diameter, has a seat inside it, kind of a board, and he would be lowered down on cables by his topside mates, his crew, and then would have to find these wrecks. Now, the Mississippi is as muddy down there as it is at the surface, so finding them was largely a matter of feel and sounding rods. And sometimes Eads and his team would have to search a section of river for a week before they would come up with where a wreck happened. I should say something about the wrecks. So in the 1840s, 1850s, steamboats are the semi-trucks of the West. Mm-hmm. There are no roads, very few roads. There's very few railroads. There's none at all in the 1840s. So if you're going to settle the West, which Americans were determined to do, they did it by steamboats on the Western rivers. And the rivers were and are amazing. So St. Louis becomes this center for steamboat trades because you can start a voyage in St. Louis and go all the way up to Fort Benton in Montana, 2,000 miles away. Wow. You can go all the way up the Mississippi to the headwaters up above Minneapolis, St. Paul. You can go downstream on the Mississippi, hang a left turn into the Ohio, and then head up the Ohio River and find yourself back in Pennsylvania. Mm. So, and then, of course, when you head south down the Mississippi, you've got the whole south of the country all the way to New Orleans. So the rivers were natural highways. Steamboats traveled those rivers, but they blew up, they sank, they caught fire, they had all sorts of calamities. And the average, there were about 700 boats on the Western rivers in 1850, but boats lasted no more than 3 years on average. Fortunately for Eads, we sometimes don't appreciate how sophisticated they could be then. All those boats were insured. So when they sank, there was an insurance payout that had to happen. And that also meant that when Eads got into the salvage business, there were a lot of insurance companies that were really happy. Here was a man that was going to cut their losses, recover some of their losses.
Right.
So that's the first chapter in Eads' professional career. Gives him a lot of knowledge about what's happening in the bottom of the river, the currents, the sand, the silt. So he does so well in that career that he retires from actively working on the water by the age of 37, and he's got a fortune. But that he's not a guy to sit around the house. So that's just chapter one. I can tell you about chapter two if you're ready.
No, and then the war is going to happen.
Yep.
And he's known for this because some of these were built here in the Carondelet area.
Yep. So the war comes within a week of the fall of Fort Sumter. Eads gets a telegram from the Attorney General of the United States. He's an old friend. He's a man named Edwin Bates. And Bates sends him a telegram. Come, I may need you in Washington. If I call, come instantly. we will need your knowledge of the use of steam upon our waters. Mm-hmm. So sure enough, he gets that telegram. Within a few days, he's ushered into the White House to a cabinet meeting with Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. And Eads tells the cabinet, yeah, Edwin Bates is right. We could put a fleet of gunboats onto the Mississippi and get control of the river, run the Confederate shipping off, and if you're really committed to this idea, we could send that brown water navy all the way downstream, bisect the Confederacy, cut it in two, take New Orleans, and really have a great strategic weapon to win the war. So Eads agrees with, I mean, it's Bates's idea, but Eads is like, yeah, I can make that happen. And so the Navy Department and the War Department, they start really thinking about this, and they draw up plans for a new kind of warship. Eads didn't draw the plans, but he did advise on it. And by August of 1861, the War Department puts these plans out to bid, and Eads is the successful bidder to build seven ironclad warships. These are each 175 feet long. They each weigh 500 tons. One specification says they got to have no more than 6 feet of draft because they have to operate in shallow waters. Mm-hmm. So Eads is the successful bidder to build these things. And so they award him the contract with a provision that says the first one of these has to be delivered in 65 days. Now, when he did this, no. Eads had never built a warship. He didn't own a shipyard. He didn't own an ironworks. He didn't own a machine shop. So you're talking about nerve is driving
Gall.
This man. Yeah,
really?
Sure enough. So, but he gets the contract, goes to work. There were some delays, in part caused because the War Department changed the specifications on him. So the first one he got done a few days late, but it was like day 69, and he gets it done. He gets all of them done by December, and they are officially accepted. I should say, while he's building them, he's got to convince his own friends to finance this because he's not getting paid. So imagine, here's a guy, he's basically saying, yeah, I'm going to pull this off. Nobody's ever done this, but I'm going to pull this off, and you should put your money on me. And imagine if it didn't work. Imagine if the ships were too heavy, they were too slow, the War Department didn't take them. Everybody would have been out,
right.
but they all had confidence in Eads. The ships are accepted by the War Department by January. They go into battle a month later, and they win. So they go into key battles at Fort Henry and Fort Donelson on the Tennessee River. They are the Marine force that is supporting U.S. Grant in a campaign to take those forts. They win. And Grant gets credit, too. The soldiers get credit,
right,
too.
Right.
But they win. Those are the first big Union victories of the war. They make a hero out of Grant. And they quickly lead to the collapse. Kentucky withdraws from any support for the Confederacy. So Kentucky is no longer in the balance. And eventually, those victories will lead Union forces right across Tennessee. So it's a big, big win. And a real nervy move by Captain Eads.
Wow.
I should say he's called Captain Eads because of all that salvage work that he did. It would be a title he would bear for the rest of his life.
We're talking to John Brown. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Virginia School of Engineering and the author of his latest book is Spanning the Gilded Age, James Eads and the Great Steel Bridge. His innovative kind of innovative. He was a real dreamer in some respects, and like a very good salesman. And yeah, I can do that. And you better pull it off the first time. But he did pull it off. And even his designs for the diving bell and when he was doing his salvage business, he devised a lot of certain kinds of systems to work. He really knew the river, which put him in a great place to build a bridge across the Mississippi River. But there's a backstory to getting bridges across the Mississippi River. There's, you know, congressional kinds of things. There's Illinois and all those kinds of things put together. And then the railroads were pushing their own agendas. How does this all culminate here? Because bridges were built way ahead of St. Louis. Like, the St. Charles Bridge, the Columbia Bridge, Kansas City Bridge, bridges in Iowa, before this bridge was finally completed. Let's kind of delve into the bridge kind of portion of this.
Would we say this is the first bridge that crossed the Mississippi River for St. Louis?
It is the first one in St. Louis. Absolutely clear about that. Mm. So it's a great stew of questions you just raised here, Arnold.
pick whichever one you want.
Well, no, but it is. It's a great stew of questions. So for the railroads that most Americans want to see built into the West, clearly getting bridges across the Missouri and the Mississippi River are crucial. That is going to be the big challenge. So, and as it turns out, the Mississippi is much, much easier to bridge if you are north of the confluence with the Missouri River. Mm-hmm. If you're working on the upper Mississippi, as it's called, that's not easy, but doing a bridge below the confluence is devilishly difficult. So a number of bridges do go in above St. Louis. The first is at Rock Island, Illinois. The next one is at Clinton, Iowa. Those two are Rock Island's 1856, Clinton's 1864. And then as the war is winding down, all the Midwest politicians are clamoring for federal support for more bridges. So the Congress sits down and debates and then eventually passes a piece of legislation, the Omnibus Bridge Act, which authorizes, I think it's 8 bridges all told, at various locations up and down the Mississippi, and one at Kansas City on the Missouri. So here the Congress has stepped in and said, we want these things to happen. Congress has a role because they are all interstate bridges. So the ventures want this federal imprimatur for their work. So, but now there's another key point to that is a little unusual to emphasize. Today, when we think of bridges, we think of governments building them. But then it was almost all private sector work. And in fact, surprisingly, it wasn't necessarily railroads themselves. So the railroads wanted to save capital wherever they could. Building a railroad was a pretty expensive thing. So most of these bridges on the Western rivers were built by companies, private sector companies that were established to have the right, so they would get charters, and then they'd raise the money, they'd subcontract the bridge work itself to specialists, and then the plan was open the bridge and money will shower down on you because you'll charge tolls and everybody will need to get across, and how could you lose? That was the plan. There is some evidence that a young salesman for a bridge company was pushing an idea to fix prices for every bridge or ferry across the Mississippi River. And in this plan, what he was dreaming of was literally the entire commerce of the continent would have to pay a fixed price to get across the river.
Wow.
Yeah. So that young man's name was Andrew Carnegie.
Ooh.
Now, there's no evidence that it actually happened, but it does give you a sense of Carnegie's dreams of wealth, shall we say. So they start building these bridges after the Omnibus Bridge Act. That's 1866. We know that in St. Louis, there were 5 serious ventures underway by 1867 to build a bridge. So it wasn't just Eads dreaming about this. And St. Louis was a really special target for these ventures because it's the leading city of the West. It's already a real hub in commerce, thanks to the steamboat era. So if they can get a bridge over St. Louis, they think, well, we'll make a pile of dough here. And so I really like to emphasize that part of the story because Eads is imaginative. He's got some great ideas, but he has no experience in bridging at all. And he's going up against 4 other ventures, all of which have really long resumes and lots of experience in bridging. Hmm. So people don't necessarily recollect John Roebling, the man of the Brooklyn Bridge. He wanted to build a bridge at St. Louis and did complete designs for it. So to my mind, that makes Eads really even more impressive. A guy who hits this, as I put it, a grand slam home run the first time he goes at bat, and it turns out he's playing in the major leagues. So pretty cool.
It's crazy. A 13-year-old
dropout,
yeah, right?
Right?
But he investigated things, he learned things, he read, and became astute to what was going on with building bridges. And those bridges were constructed how? Because that's another key thing, I think, where the leap goes with Eads, is he changed the trajectory of that.
He sure did. So the Rock Island Bridge that I mentioned, 1856, that's mostly made out of wood. The bridge, even the bridge at Kansas City, which is, I think, finished around 1869, it's mostly made out of wood. Now, the rest of them are all made out of iron. So there's this big transition going on right after the Civil War to shift from wooden bridges to iron. But Eads is going to skip right over iron if he can. His original plans, he doesn't quite go as far as he wants, but the original plan is to build this thing out of steel. And he does force a revolution in steel. He's 20 years ahead of the times in specifying steel. It proves a real challenge, and I'm sure we'll get to some of those challenges. But in the end, yes, the Eads Bridge at St. Louis, those arches that are its characteristic design, the real graceful arches, mm-hmm. they are made out of steel.
And he had a vision for what he wanted to do, but he had also been to Europe and to France and to England and had consulted with some engineers and, I don't want to call them architects, but architectural engineers and some those kind of folks over there. But he also had seen one of these designs that, I don't know, was that the basis for his design for the Eads Bridge?
I think largely it was. So Eads has this habit over the course of his adult life where he works really hard on a project, and then he has this period of collapse where he can't do a thing. And, in fact, his doctors feared for his life. So in the Civil War, he did work very hard on these ironclad warships, and then he literally does have this period where his doctor feared for his life, sent him off on an ocean voyage to Europe so that he could recover from and get some rest, R&R. And he's on a cruise with his second wife on the Rhine, and he sees a bridge at Koblenz in Prussia, and it's a three-arch bridge that carries a railroad line over the Rhine. And Eads thinks, wow, that's a graceful structure, and that could be a great way to put a bridge over the Mississippi at St. Louis. And by that time, Eads is himself investing in Western railroads that are hoping to go from the Mississippi all the way out to the Pacific coast. Mm. And so he knows that a bridge is going to make a real difference in the success of those ventures. So when he comes back, he's got some irons in the fire with these railroad ventures, and then pretty quickly he realizes, well, the bridge needs to be his number one focus, and he's throwing himself into that by 1867. And then, even as he's working on the bridge, he goes back to Europe. He's in Europe in 1869, again after one of these periods of collapse, overwork. And on that trip, he meets bankers in London. He meets French steelmakers in Paris. And he meets a great number of French engineers. And that's when he sees how the French are going to build their foundations all the way down to bedrock. So for Eads, he's worked salvage jobs on the river. He knows the Mississippi is a terribly powerful force, and he's determined that his bridge is going to have stone piers that get built up from bedrock. Well, think about that for a minute. How do you do that? Well, the Europeans had figured it out. Nobody had figured it out in America, and Eads would observe that technique. It's called pneumatic caissons, and he would bring it back to North America and introduce it successfully here at St. Louis. And the other wrinkle about that I love is the Roeblings know they need to do the same thing for the Brooklyn Bridge, and Washington Roebling comes out to St. Louis, descends 100 feet beneath the surface of the river to stand on bedrock, and he soaks up every bit of knowledge and insight that he can, and then he goes back to Brooklyn and succeeds in Brooklyn.
Yeah, we think, Mark, that the Brooklyn Bridge is this, yeah, that's the bridge. That's the bridge of the United States, where the Eads Bridge was built before that.
Yeah. It's got nothing on the Eads Bridge.
No, nothing on it.
Nothing on
different kind of bridge. Great techniques. Yeah. You know, we're having a great conversation today with Dr. John Brown. He's author and professor emeritus at the University of Virginia School of Engineering. And we're talking about his latest book, which is entitled Spanning the Gilded Age, James Eads and the Great Steel Bridge. I want to give you some information because he's going to be at the Schlafly Library on North Euclid tonight at 6 p.m. That is May the 23rd. Left Bank Books is the sponsor for bringing John into St. Louis and talking about the book. And if you want to get more information on his book or purchase it, you can go to greatsteelbridge.com, greatsteelbridge.com. Well, we're going to take a brief break, and we're going to come back at a ton more questions, John, about this, and we'll get some more information out to listeners about the Eads Bridge. This is Arnold Stricker with Mark Langston of St. Louis in Tune. Stay tuned. This is Arnold Stricker of St. Louis in Tune on behalf of the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. In 1857, the Dred Scott decision was a major legal event and catalyst that contributed to the Civil War. The decision declared that Dred Scott could not be free because he was not a citizen. The 14th Amendment, also called the Dred Scott Amendment, granted citizenship to all born or naturalized here in our country and was intended to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court decision on July 9, 1868. The Dred Scott Heritage Foundation is requesting a commemorative stamp to be issued from the U.S. Postal Service to recognize and remember the heritage of this amendment by issuing a stamp with the likeness of the man Dred Scott. But we need your support and the support of thousands of people who would like to see this happen. To achieve this goal, we ask you to download, sign, and share the one-page petition with others. To find the petition, please go to dredscottlives.org and click on the Dred Scott Petition Drive on the right side of the page. On behalf of the
United States has a strong tradition of welcoming newcomers and refugees. The Welcome Corps is a new service opportunity for Americans inspired to welcome those seeking freedom and safety and in turn help strengthen their own communities. Welcome Corps is a public-private partnership that is inspired by what Americans represent to so many around the world, a beacon of hope and refuge. All it takes is a helping hand. Are you ready to learn more? Contact the International Institute of St. Louis at info@iistl.org or call 314-773-9090. That's info@iistl.org or call 314-773-9090.
St. Louis in Tune strives to bring you informative, useful, and reflective stories and interviews about current and historic issues and events that involve people, places, and things. Our topics cover a wide range, such as the arts, crime, education, employment, faith, finance, food, health, history, housing, humor, justice, and even sports. And that's just to name a few. While St. Louis in Tune originates from the Gateway City and covers local topics, we connect to what is going on nationally as well. If you enjoy what you hear, please take time and like and share and subscribe to this show and listen to other previous shows that can be found on our website, stlintune.com. That's stlintune.com. Or on your favorite podcast platform. That's stlintune.com. stlintune.com. And if you've got an idea that you'd like for us to examine a little deeper, let us know by dropping us a note at stlintune@gmail.com. That's stlintune@gmail.com. St. Louis in Tune, heard Monday through Friday on the usradionetwork.com and many great radio stations around the U.S. and, of course, right here in St. Louis. Our website again is stlintune.com. We want to hear from you. stlintune.com.
Welcome back to St. Louis in Tune with Arnold Stricker and Mark Langston. We are having a great conversation with Dr. John Brown, author and professor emeritus at the University of Virginia School of Engineering. We're talking to him about his latest book, Spanning the Gilded Age, James Eads and the Great Steel Bridge. Mark, what a wonderful time we're having here.
It is. I have one of those odd questions, though, for the doctor.
Okay.
I seem to remember at some point they were talking about putting condominiums, he's shaking his head, yes, on the Eads Bridge. It was fascinating to me, but I always thought it was going to ruin such a beautiful bridge. But I think it was below where the train tracks were between the...
So I know what you're talking about, and it is a head-scratcher. But so what happened with the bridge was its original function was largely roadway traffic on the upper deck charging a toll, rail traffic on the lower deck, dual-track railroad. Well, by the early 1970s, the rail traffic is essentially dead. There's not much need for that. There's also another rail bridge, two other rail bridges by then that are in service, and the owner of the Eads Bridge, at that point the Terminal Railroad Association, really got to the point where they were saying the taxes are costing us more than it's worth to maintain the thing. So everybody was having a head scratcher what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a graduate student in architecture at WashU who said, well, why don't we put condos on it? And boy, you'd have have the best view of the river and the city.
Yeah.
And so some lovely drawings were done that was published in a magazine, and fortunately everybody forgot about it almost immediately.
Good.
Except you, Mark. You remember.
Right, I'm the one that did. Because I was going to buy one.
Yeah.
I guess you'd have a lot of parking on top. I don't
know. Yeah, I guess you would.
Okay, that's my odd question.
Yes, your odd question.
A stranger than fiction.
Yeah, oh, my. Dr. Brown's going to be at Left Bank Books. Left Bank Books is the sponsor. He's going to be at Schlafly Library tonight, May the 23rd at 6 p.m. That's the North Euclid area over there. If you want more information, also on his book, GreatSteelBridge.com, GreatSteelBridge.com, 85 illustrations. And these are illustrations I've never seen before. You know, you see the basic, you know, bridge illustrations, but this is some great stuff in here. Now, John, on the innovations, I know I'd mentioned that steel was going to be a big innovation. He also, with the pneumatic caisson, I want you to explain that, because as you were writing about that and I was trying to kind of visualize what that looked like, and you really went into detail about that. And this was like what we see out in the middle of the river. Those things, you would think, oh, maybe they're 20 feet deep. You know, those suckers are like maybe 100 feet deep on the east side.
Yep.
And then the derricks that kind of held the suspension portion together before they got it together. Can you elaborate on that stuff?
So think a minute. If your goal is to build what amounts to a stone tower, that's what those two river piers are, how are you going to do that? How are you going to get them all the way down to bedrock? So Eads read about a method that had been developed in Europe, originally by the French engineers, and it used what they called a pneumatic caisson. So the way I describe it is, imagine a giant box, like a shoe box, but it's upside down, and there's no bottom on it. So it's open at the bottom, but it is a box. And Eads' caissons actually were hexagonal in shape, and they were 82 – the eastern one was 82 feet long and 60 feet wide. It was made in a shipyard and launched as if it was a ship.
These were iron?
This was plate iron,
okay,
riveted together, and then it gets hauled by tugboats out into the river. And now the question is, well, where does it go? How do you keep it where you want it? So they had driven with pile drivers, they had driven wooden pilings into the sandy riverbed. So they had a spot all set and ready, and so then the tugboats push the caisson up against the pilings, and then a pile driver comes in and pins it into place. The last side is all pinned into place. So now it can't go anywhere. You've got this thing floating in the river. Then Eads brings out these pontoon boats that he has designed, and they have these cranes on them. So, and one pontoon boat ties up to one side of the caisson, the other to the other side. Next, they start bringing out barges with stone, cut stone. The barges are brought out with tugboats. They tie up next to the pontoon boats, and on those pontoon boats, crane operators run these cranes, very much like modern-day tower cranes. Mm-hmm. And the operators can use their crane to pluck a 7-ton piece of stone off a barge, carry it right across the pontoon boat, and place that piece of stone onto the caisson. Now, every time they put a new piece of stone on the caisson, that's adding weight, that's forcing the caisson down. There are stonemasons hard at work on the caissons, and they are mortaring the stones together and making a real pier out of it. So each, as I put it, is a kind of brute force ballet, where each one of these stones is going to force that caisson deeper into the river while building the pier up. And this process goes on until the caisson reaches the riverbed, the sand. So then we go into a new phase, because they got to get through 60 feet of sand and gravel to arrive at bedrock. So, and in a way, the real challenges are just starting. Mm-hmm. So to make that happen, well, when they built the stone pier to this point, they left inside the core of it, they built inside the core an iron circular staircase. And so now with that staircase, they can get down to the caisson. At the bottom of the staircase, they arrive at an airlock. So, and when they want to start to send the men down there, they've also left piping inside the stone, so they can pipe compressed air down into the caisson, and that forces any water that's gotten into there, it forces the water out, and it keeps Mississippi water from entering, but that's now a pressurized environment in the caisson. So the laborers, they were called sand hogs. When they went down that circular staircase, they had to go through the airlock and enter the caisson, and once there, they started their work of digging away, digging down to get to bedrock. Now, there's another problem which Eads saw in advance and designed for. You're in this closed box, this pressurized box. How do you get the spoil out? How do you get the sand out of the way?
Right.
You're not going to get to shovel it right under the edge of the caisson. You got to have some way to get it out. You don't want to carry it up the circular staircase, nope, bucket after bucket.
Nope.
He came up with what he called an ejector. And this was a technology with no moving parts that would suck the sand out of the sumps. They had sump areas in the caisson, suck the sand out of that and eject it out into the river. So that used river water under pressure to work, and Eads's sand pumps were so good that they worked flawlessly. They could even deal with stones and rocks that were the size of a human fist. They became a technology that was used everywhere from this point on when they were doing this kind of work. So that's the basics of how they keep going down and down and down. Mm. But there's a problem. You go deeper and deeper, the pressure inside the caisson has to rise to keep the water out.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets to a point where it becomes very unpleasant, to say the least. Until that happened, until it got to that point, people would go visit. If you were a well-connected friend of James Eads, you could get a pass and go down the circular staircase and through the airlock, and you could watch all of what was happening right there in front of you. The environment was lit by kerosene lamps. It was very smoky. It was surprisingly hot because it was under pressure.
Mm.
So these Irish, mostly Irish, native-born American laborers are shoveling away, and people would come, they'd observe this. But as the depth went further down, the number of visitors tapered off because it became pretty unpleasant. The workers started to be struck down by these mysterious aches and pains. People didn't know what the cause was, but clearly it had something to do with working in that environment. And we now know they had decompression sickness, what they called the bends. So,
right.
And to deal with that, he knew this would be a problem because he had done enough research to know what was happening in Europe. In Europe, engineers decided that 75 feet was about the maximum depth you could ask anybody to work at. But Eads knew he'd have to go a lot deeper than that. So when the men started to get sick, Eads realized he had to fix this. He had to do something. He had to speak to the problem. So he had his own family physician come investigate this. And before Dr. Jaminet was done, Eads had to build a hospital on a workboat that was tied right to the pier so that men who were really badly afflicted could be treated in that hospital. So Eads would go down to the case on pretty much every day. And by this point, he's a 50-year-old man. Now, these other guys, they're in their early 20s. But Eads is doing this clearly quite on purpose. He's making a point that he's going to make this work and they're going to make it work.
If I can do this, you can do this.
Exactly. That really was it. But before the work was done, 13 men would die of decompression sickness. Oh. And what was really poignant about it is they'd go to work, they'd come up out of their working shift, they'd come up that circular staircase, and then the pains would hit them hard. Hmm. Because the cause of all of this is in that pressurized environment, nitrogen, which naturally occurs in all of us, it's in our bloodstream as a gas, but in that pressurized environment, the pressure makes the gas fall out of the blood and form bubbles of nitrogen. Mm. And those bubbles of nitrogen then get caught in muscular tissue in our bodies, and that's what causes the pain. Mm. And we know how to solve that now. But they didn't know then. So these guys would come up from their working shift. They'd gone down fully healthy. Some of them would die 15 minutes after they came back to the surface. And their deaths were terribly painful. So this was very hard on everybody to watch it happen.
Now, I'm going to stop you there.
Wow.
Because if you want to find out more about the other things that I mentioned, he goes into detail in this book, and you really need to check this out. It's an easy read if you love history. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you go into some great detail here. Some people would say, well, this is like a dissertation book. No, it's factual. He even checks the sources of the biographers and says, yeah, that wasn't exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of bibliography in here. You've done a tremendous amount of work here, so I don't want to spoil people's fascination for learning the things that I learned reading the book. And so I'm going to leave the case on, the pneumatic case on there. We won't talk about the other things because I really want to get into the financing of this, because this was like, it was almost like a shell game.
Yeah, I'm being a little grudging here because I've learned a lot. And it turns out a lot of the finance story that I tell in this book would be entirely familiar to a venture capitalist today.
Okay.
So yeah. A lot of this is how we do this in America.
Not you and I or Mark.
No,
but the people who really have the
those
stuff.
VC guys out in Silicon Valley. They know this story. They live this story. So Eads is brilliant at telling a good tale, at getting people excited about his vision. So, and he realizes that he needs to tell a good tale because he's asking people to put money into something that, let's face it, is really risky. So let's pause a minute, tick off those risks. He wants to build a bridge in St. Louis where nobody's ever done it before. He'd like to use steel, which nobody's ever used before. Mm-hmm. He's going to use these pneumatic caissons, which nobody's ever done in America before. And oh, by the way, he's never done a bridge before. So, and now to get this going, he needs to get people to pony up the cash to make it happen. So he comes up with an initial estimate that the bridge is going to cost $5 million in 1868 dollars. So, and then he's like, okay, well, if I'm going to get people to invest in this, they need to do well. So he then rethinks how much money he wants to raise. So $5 million to build the bridge, but once it's in operation, he figures it could service the securities worth $10 million. In other words, once the bridge is in business and earning money on the tolls, mm-hmm. it will earn enough money so that he can service $10 million in securities. So he's like, okay, well, we're not going to raise $5 million. We're going to raise $10 million. And what we're going to do is use half of that to build the bridge, and the other half is going to reward the investors. So if you buy stock in my company, you might buy, $100,000 worth of stock. But when we're done, you're going to have reward of $400,000 in stocks and bonds. So that was the pitch, and that pitch worked. He convinced 55 investors, mostly wealthy men of St. Louis and New York, and they put their money in. And among them was J.P. Morgan in New York, one of the very early ventures he invested in. And he talked his father, who was really the big man in banking at that point, Junius Morgan, who was in London, and the two of them invest. Let me add, then and now, any venture that says, I'll give you a 400% rate of return, everybody knows that's risky. You don't get that chance on a safe bet. You're getting a chance, but it's on a risky bet. But nonetheless, he is such a persuasive, charismatic guy that he convinces these people to put their money in. So that's pretty cool. And that is much like investment today, where these VC guys, they're putting their money in, but they also know that if this venture works, they're going to harvest their take early, like with the initial public offering. They don't have to sit around and wait for the tolls. They're going to make their money quickly.
Right.
So financing by debt is how Eads did it then. It's how we do it today. Offering serious reward to the initial investors, Eads did it then. That's how we do it today.
And they also had their finger in, I should say this, some of the railroad folks, matter of fact, the Pennsylvania Railroad, they had their finger in a bridge building company, which was competing against and actually ended up being the, what I would call the, one of the people that would actually do the superstructure.
Right. So this part of the story is, I think, distinctly Gilded Age, where you have people who see the country's industrializing, they're awarding contracts for this, that, and the other thing, and there are no laws against insider trading whatsoever. So the top officers of the biggest railroad in the country, which was the Pennsylvania Railroad, it's not just the biggest railroad in the country, it's the biggest corporation in the world. So those officers see that there's all sorts of money-making opportunities that come from running our show here, and so they set up a bridge company, the Keystone Bridge Company. And then when the railroad needs a bridge, well, funny thing, the contract goes to Keystone. And the ownership of Keystone is quite closely held, by the same railroad officers. So
coincidence.
In that case, Keystone is going to need a lot of iron to build its bridges. Oh, well, it's going to turn to an ironworks called Carnegie Cloman and Company. So there's a lot of this insider business that's happening. Now, in the case of the bridge, Eads wants an alliance with the Pennsylvania Railroad because it's this powerful corporation. He knows they can help. An alliance with the PRR is going to help him sell bonds. It's going to help him with business for the bridge, too, because the Pennsylvania Railroad wants a route, a link into St. Louis. So there's lots of reasons to work together, and so they ink a deal. They come together. But as it turns out, once I dug and found a little more, it turns out actually that the PRR guys, they wanted to build a bridge at St. Louis, but they didn't really want to build Eads' bridge.
Right.
It was too risky. They didn't think much of steel, and they knew how to build iron bridges. Keystone had been building a lot of them. So they did the deal to get themselves in at St. Louis, but they didn't expect Eads would succeed. They figured Eads would fail, and then they'd be standing right there on the spot, ready to put up their own iron bridge and make even more money. So in the story, it becomes pretty quickly clear that Eads has to fight with his own prime contractor to get them to do what they've agreed to do. And in fairness, it's not all one-sided. Keystone was right that steel was a very risky bet, and it screwed up the construction schedules, delayed construction by upwards of 2 years. So, and all of that time, there's still costs for the bridge company, and so costs are going up, and Keystone Bridge is going crazy because
they're tied up.
They're totally tied up. They had committed labor force and shop space to getting this thing done. So not only are they not making money on this St. Louis project, they're not making money on the other things they would have built at that time. So the two sides end up so at odds that the first thing that happens is Eads thinks Carnegie and Keystone are slow walking the project so that they can renegotiate. There's plenty of evidence that's true. Then finally, they do renegotiate. They get the bridge largely done, and then Carnegie orders armed guards out onto the bridge to seize it and to keep the people of St. Louis from crossing. This is March of 1874, and Carnegie has no intention of surrendering the bridge until there is a settlement of monies owed. So it's a pretty sour way to end up there.
Really? So, quite sour,
yep,
I would say.
But the key point is they get it done. So they make it happen. The bridge that Eads estimated would cost $5 million, in the end, it was $12.5 million.
Wow.
So, but in again, in fairness to Eads, there are similar numbers about the Brooklyn Bridge. So a new technologically venturesome project is going to have a cost overrun. I can assure you the Channel Tunnel ended up costing a lot more than the promoters thought it would when they started, whenever that was, 1980s maybe.
Yeah, speaking of tunnels, you know, we're just talking about the bridge over the Mississippi here, Mark. We're not talking about the approach from Illinois. Or now that the trains are coming across the bridge, where do they go? They had to build a tunnel on Washington Avenue. It's the tunnel that actually the Metrolink is using right now.
Right.
And then, now, okay, so where are they going to go down to, you know, Chodos Pond area, which ended up being where the station was? So that was a whole other financing portion that John goes into in the book.
Well, financing portion, but I want to correct you one thing, Arnold. That tunnel was most unusual. So in every other city in America at this point, railroad trains, those belching steam locomotives, they ran in the street because the city fathers wanted the railroads. They were not going to make it hard for a railroad who wanted to come to town. So it was typical for railroad trains to run right down through the main drag of a street.
Crazy.
So that was true in Broad Street in Philadelphia. In New York City, 10th Avenue was devoted to railroad lines, and so many New Yorkers were killed by those trains that New Yorkers nicknamed it Death Alley. In Syracuse, New York, trains ran down the main drag of Syracuse, New York. I love the coincidence, Washington Street. They ran down the main drag of Syracuse, New York, 60 trains a day for nearly a century. So this was normal in American cities. So when Eads says, no, I'm not going to do that to St. Louis, I'm going to put trains in a tunnel, that was quite exceptional. And the tunnel is 4,400 feet long, which for that time put it among the longest in America. It really did set this whole idea apart, this dual-track tunnel. And as you say, yes, that's the Metrolink tunnel to this day. And Eads also designed the tunnel. So, you know.
And he was not a tunnel designer either.
No.
Why would he be?
But he was after this.
So people who arrived in St. So that tunnel worked well. Of course, running steam locomotives inside a tunnel has some downsides.
I was thinking the same thing as you said it.
It does have some downsides. Right. They realized that, and by the 1880s, they had built this massive exhaust tower and an exhaust fan to get the foul air out of that tunnel. But if you had arrived in St. Louis by rail right into the 1950s, you didn't really look forward to that trip
tunnel
through
ride.
The tunnel. No.
The tunnel ride.
Yeah, we've just got a couple minutes here, John, so I have a couple quick questions. By the way, you can see John tonight. This is Thursday, May 23rd, at 6 o'clock p.m. at the Schlafly Library on North Euclid. It's sponsored by Left Bank Books. You can also go to greatsteelbridge.com and get more information and purchase the book there. What was the biggest aha or wow, I never knew that? And with your background, you've known a lot. So what was, as you investigated this book and did the research, what stood out to you?
Well, I can give you two bits. There were a lot that stood out. So one bit was, so Andrew Carnegie is this big figure in American industrial history, mm-hmm. and he lived longer than everybody else. He wrote an autobiography. He tells about his experiences here in St. Louis with AIDS, and everything he says is wrong. And wow. So that got me to digging, and all I'll say is, in my book, Carnegie doesn't come out looking very well. He doesn't. He really, in some ways, is the villain of the story. The other thing that is really amazing is there was a bad cyclone that hit St. Louis in 1871, and Eads was behind schedule at that point. He should have had the superstructure well underway, but he didn't. Trouble with steel. But that cyclone makes him think, have we designed well enough for wind loads? So since the superstructure is not up, he orders his assistant engineers to redesign for wind loading. And they build a wind truss under the roadway up the upper deck. And so that truss has its big test in 1896,
right,
when a brutal, brutal cyclone hits St. Louis. Over 200 people are killed. It's rated among the worst ever to hit America. The bridge took a direct hit, mostly on its eastern approaches over in East St. Louis. It ripped the roadway deck off the bridge there. It derailed a train that just happened to be crossing at that time. But the steel arches come through unscathed, and they're able to repair the bridge within 48 hours. There's trains running back over it, bringing relief to St. Louis. So when you consider that bridge in Baltimore, well, turns out James Eads knew how to make a bridge that would last.
Yeah, and to kind of piggyback off that, there were windstorms and tornadoes that went through, and the St. Charles Bridge, which was built by that part of that collapse, mm-hmm. the Kansas City Bridge collapse, the one in Iowa.
Junk.
Had yep. It collapsed, and it was that old-style iron work mm-hmm. rather than the steel.
Mm-hmm. Yep, sure enough. One last thing, because my wife tells me I have to mention it. So when they were nearly finished the bridge, they wanted to make sure it was safe. They ran locomotives across to make sure that it would carry the load. They did carry the load, no problem. But then somebody said, let's put an elephant across the bridge. We want to see if an elephant will walk across. It wasn't about testing the weight. It was that everybody knew elephants are wise. And a wise elephant would never, ever walk onto something that was unsafe. An elephant would detect some tremors, some problems, and would turn around and not do it. So this was a way they tested the bridge in 1874. I want them to walk an elephant over that bridge on July 4th of this year, the 150th anniversary.
That would be great.
It would be pretty cool.
Quality control.
That's right. Well, you would be wise to get this book, Spanning the Gilded Age, James Eads and the Great Steel Bridge, by John Brown. He's been our guest today. He's also going to be at the Schlafly Library tonight. That's May 23rd at 6 p.m. at Left Bank Books is the sponsor for that. You can also get his book at greatsteelbridge.com.
You'll be signing, John, I guess, the Brooks?
I will be signing.
Taking questions, I hope.
And I promise I won't talk too long, and I'd love to hear from an audience with any questions. That would be great.
There you go. Yeah. There you go, folks.
Yeah. Wow. How fun.
Unbelievable.
And
book.
It's still standing.
Yes.
And engineers think it will make it into the next century.
I believe that.
I wish we could use it more. That's what I think. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see, but I wish we could use it more. So walk across it.
Yeah, so if you're in St. Louis, drive across, walk across, take MetroLink across, mm-hmm. you know, check it out, walk underneath, buy right. down on the Laclede's Landing and see right. how it's put together.
It's always fun.
It yeah. would be. Well, that's all for this hour.
Really? That's too bad. I wish I had so many more stories you could tell.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate the chance to do this. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank yeah. you for coming in. It's been a pleasure to have you.
We've had a great time.
It's Thank been you. Wonderful. If you've enjoyed this show, you can listen to additional shows at stlintune.com, stlintune.com. Consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or your preferred podcast platform. Your feedback helps us reach more listeners and continue to grow. We want to thank Bob Berthasell for our theme music, co-host Mark Langston, and we thank you for being a part of our community of curious minds. St. Louis in Tune is a production of Motif Media Group and the U.S. Radio Network. Remember to keep seeking, keep learning, walk worthy, and let your light shine. For St. Louis in Tune, I'm Arnold Stricker.